party council?
Aye.
Both sides ready?
Yes.
Please proceed.
Good morning, please, as a court. The court on its notice for today's oral argument had identified a particular statute it wanted the attorneys to address. And let me first address that. The statute is clear, at least in the language, that 57161B3 does apply. I mean, it refers to subsection 571-119, which is the 587, the Child Protective Act. So on its face, at least, it appears that the requirements that a verified petition be filed and served upon a party in a termination proceedings must occur, and it must occur at least 20 days before the hearing. Now, having said that, in my review, at least, of the legislative history, 57161 was established in 1965. And in it, it included the provisions which would allow for the termination of parental rights. Subsequent thereto, there were various amendments, and it appears, at least in my review of the legislative history, some of the changes to the 571 statute sort of dealt with adoption, legal guardianships, et cetera. Because it was not until 1983 that 587, Chapter 587 was enacted, the Child Protective Child Protective Act. When 587 was established, it did in 587-72H1, it did refer to Section 571-61, which required again the requirements of a termination of parental rights. So at least when Chapter 587 was established, it was in reference, or there was a reference to 571-61. There were some changes in Chapter 587, but I think what is probably more significant is that in 1992 or 1993, 587 was amended, and in that amendment, the reference in Section 587-72 to 571-61 apparently was deleted. So as of 1992 and 1993, there is no reference in 587-72, which is the review section, to 571-61, which is the TPR section.
Is there any legislative history as to why that reference was deleted?
I tried to, you know, garner the legislative history in terms of tracking it, and I could not identify why that occurred. Other than it appears in 587, when it was amended in 1992 and 93, it created a more comprehensive Child Protective Act in terms of identifying the new terms permanent custody and permanent hearings. So I'm not sure, in light of more intrinsic and detailed procedures, whether there was an assumption or there was an intent to eliminate the reference to 571-61.
Now, are you familiar with, in practice, whether this provision is ever honored? Because it didn't seem, in this case, like anyone even batted an eye and raised any concern about, one, the timing of the motion, and two, the fact that the motion was not personally served on the mother. In this case, it appears that the only reference to service is service on the attorney.
In candor, those, I think, well, at least in my practice in 587 cases, it is true. It does not appear that there has been in the past specific references to 571-61, B3, in terms of any motion to terminate parental rights. That maybe have been earlier on before the amendment in 1992-93. But subsequent to that, as far as I'm aware, I'm not cognizant of the practice that there needs to be a filing under 571-61.
All right, but if we look at the statute on its face, literally, it does require that the petition for termination of parental rights be served personally on the parent within 20 days prior to the hearing.
That is correct.
And in this case, the record shows that clearly was not done.
That's correct. And, you know, as I referenced in 1993 or 92, when the reference to 571-61 was deleted, you know, the legislature apparently already knew 587 was established, and even in 571-11-9, it refers to cases involving 587 cases. So it could be argued that the legislature deleted the reference to 571-61 because under 571-11, it was obvious that Chapter 587 of the Child Protective Act fell within the premise of 571-61.
Now, are you aware of any rule, family court rule or other rule, that would be inconsistent with this requirement? In other words, that would permit a motion or petition for termination of parental rights to go forward without compliance, some less strict standard?
I'm not aware of it. You know, both, I think, Chapter 587 and even the rules, you know, the term motion is used interchangeably at times, and I don't believe, other than the general rules that whenever you have a motion, it has to be in the proper form, it has to be accompanied by a declaration or affidavit, it needs to be noticed, et cetera, I'm not aware of any specific family court rule regarding 587 or TPR cases.
All right. Do you have anything else to add on the statute itself?
It probably doesn't help my case here, but you know, I want to point it out because there are two appellate cases that did come out. 8 Hawaii, you know, Eight Hawaii Appellate 161 and Eight Hawaii Appellate 66. This was in 1990, and in both cases, the court did refer to 571-61 as well as 587. In fact, in Eight Hawaii Appellate 66. It discusses the difference between 587 and 571. In 8 Hawaii Appellate 161, there's language there, I don't think it's a holding, but there's reference that a TPR or termination of parental rights case brought under 571-61B1E must be preceded by judicial action in a CPS case under Chapter 587. So, you know, at that time in 1999, it appeared that being cognizant of 587 being law as well as 571 existing, there was reference that you had to proceed under 571-61. But that was in 1990, so that was prior to the amendment in 1992 and 1993, which deleted that section. And I'm not aware of any case law subsequent thereto which addresses, you know, that particular issue.
Oh, all right, so putting aside that statute, what is your argument? Assuming that the hearing was not invalid because of failure to comply with 571-61, what is your argument with respect to whether the court acted properly in entering default in this case?
Well, first of all, I would argue that at that December 22nd, 2009 hearing when mother did not appear. She was represented by counsel. The record indicates that mother's counsel did not even receive the motion for permanent custody. And I'm using permanent custody as a general term. And so mother's counsel said mother was not informed that a motion had already been filed. Albeit, mother was informed at the prior hearing that there was going to be a review hearing on December 22nd and that the department intended to file a motion for permanent custody.
Okay, so give me the record sequence. So there's a hearing in November.
Correct.
What's the date in November?
I'm sorry.
November 17, 2009.
All right, so at that hearing, mother's present with counsel.
Yes.
And at that hearing, the court indicates that they set a subsequent hearing for December 22nd.
That's correct.
And the court at that hearing advises or tells the Department of Human Services, file your motion for permanent custody?
Well, the department represented through the Attorney General that the department was going to file a motion for permanent custody. That was at the November 17, 2009.
All right, but so at the November 17th hearing in which mother is present, what is being scheduled on December 22nd?
A review hearing and a return on the motion for permanent custody.
What does that mean?
Well, it's my understanding a return on a motion for permanent custody is, it's like a complaint. You get served, the return is you answer to that complaint. So it's like an answer date. Whether you're going to agree and stipulate to the motion or whether you're going to contest it and ask for a trial.
All right, so you're viewing that as simply like it's a trial setting. In other words, everyone understood that a motion was coming down, but not necessarily that December 22nd would be the trial date.
That's correct. It wasn't the trial date. The record will reflect that.
It was not the trial date.
It was not the trial date.
And was there exhibits filed prior to that date or anything that would suggest that the parties planned to go forward on the 22nd with trial?
There were exhibits submitted. I can't recall exactly. There was probably a safe family home report which identifies to the court what the child situation is, what mother's progress, if any or none, has occurred. But there's no trial exhibits, so to speak.
Okay, and is it correct that this is the first hearing that mother failed to attend in the proceedings?
That's correct. She had attended, I believe, six prior hearings. She missed December 22nd, 2009. She did appear at the motion to set aside default, which was scheduled for February 11, 2010.
All right, so what's your argument as to why the default was improper? It appears at least she had noticed there was a hearing that required her attendance. I guess there's some ambiguity as to whether what the character of that hearing precisely was going to be, but she didn't show up.
Well, number one, she did not actually receive a copy of the motion, nor did her counsel. Okay, that's number one. And that was reported to the judge at the time. Judge decided to enter default. And there is, you know, as I indicate in my memo, the judge, or at least counsel for mom, should have asked for continuance. I mean, you know, terminating a parent's right, obviously, is an important proceeding. And, you know, mother not even getting an actual copy of it, she not being informed that if she didn't show up, she's going to be defaulted and automatically she loses her rights as a mother to this child. There's nothing in the record that informs mother that if you don't show up, your rights are gone.
You know, so there's no evidentiary hearing on the permanent custody motion.
No, there's not.
So how does the court enter findings?
If the court were to look at the record, I believe the judge said, I'll adopt the findings as the Attorney General wishes. I mean, basically one statement. So there's no on the record specific findings or evidence presented for the court to make a conclusion or determination.
So the findings are based upon the reports that are attached to the motion, essentially?
Yes.
There's no live testimony or affidavits or things of that nature?
No. So, you know, again, I mean, in terms of the motion to set aside default, I think, you know, there was no prejudice to the DHS because they weren't necessarily ready for trial. Mother, you know, had a meritorious defense in saying that she was complying with progress in the service plan and services. And inexcusable neglect, I think in the record it would show mom's reported to the court and her counsel, she was at therapy and she forgot. So, in conclusion, I mean, besides that abuse of discretion in not setting aside the default, I mean, again, there's no notice to mom. She doesn't know what's going to happen. She's been present throughout, and all of a sudden she misses one hearing, and her rights are terminated. She doesn't even get the motion until after the December 22nd, 2009 hearing.
So your basic argument is a proportionality argument. In other words, it's not disputed that she had notice but didn't show up. Your argument is that because of the substantial nature of the rights involved, that transgression was not enough, or the court abused its discretion in imposing the sanction the court imposed, which basically was you lose the case.
That's correct, to some extent. I mean, and I know I'm not the client today, but had this court not given counsel notice of its interest in looking at 571-61, you know, I as counsel would have not been informed to be ready to present that issue. I think it's the same with mom. She doesn't get written notice. She doesn't know exactly what's being alleged against her. She knows, yes, they're going to say that, you know, she hasn't complied with everything. But she doesn't have the specific allegations as to why the opportunity to respond and defend and have a reasonable opportunity to respond to those allegations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Deputy Solicitor General Deirdre Marie Iha, appearing on behalf of the Department of Human Services, Appellee. Thank you for the opportunity for oral argument. We respectfully urge this Court to affirm, because notice was properly provided to Mother of the permanent plan hearing under the controlling statute 587-51.5A and 571-61-B3 does not apply. The Family Court's unchallenged findings of fact state that Mother did receive notice of the hearing on the department's motion, and the Family Court did not abuse its discretion in denying Mother's motion to set aside the default. I'd like to focus my attention on the question that the court asked. Because the question was not brief, my answer is fairly detailed. The court asked whether 571-61-B3 applies to this case. The answer is no. There are three reasons. First, Chapter 587 has its own notice provision. Second, both the legislative history and the text of Chapter 571 and 587 show that when termination of parental rights is sought in a Child Protective Act proceeding, it is done under the provisions of that chapter. And third, Hawaii case law shows that the family court's powers under one chapter are not limited by the terms of the other chapter. I note that Chapter 587 was repealed by Act 135 of the 2010 legislative session and replaced with a new Child Protective Act. Now, substantively, Chapter 587 and Act 135 are quite similar. However, Act 135 did not go into effect until September 1st of this year. So therefore, my citations are given to Chapter 587 as it existed at the time of the Family Court's actions. This proceeding was governed by Chapter 587's notice provision, 587-51.5A. By its plain terms, it applies to all hearings under that chapter and requires only 48 hours notice. This is a clear indication of legislative intent. This legislative intent is confirmed in the 2010 reenactment of the Child Protective Act, where the legislature again required only 48 hours notice. 587-51.5 controls because it is unique to Chapter 587 proceedings, including the particular manner in which termination of parental rights is accomplished under that chapter, and it was enacted in 2006, much more recently than the notice language in 571-61-B3.
So what are the statutory construction rules that you're referring to? Is it specific trumps general and later trumps older? Is that the?
No, actually, the most important rule of statutory construction that I would invoke is that in the event of ambiguity, we turn to the legislative history. And the most important enactment, in my view, is not the 1982 enactment that counsel referred to, but a 1986 change to the Child Protective Act. So with your indulgence, I'll turn to that now. The notice language from 571-61-B3 was added to that chapter in 1965, as my opponent indicated. However, it's the legislative history after that date that shows that the termination of parental rights, when you handle it under a Child Protective Act proceeding, you're governed by that chapter. When the family courts were established, there was no Child Protective Act. The Child Protective Act was enacted in 1983, and at the time, as counsel indicated, it did not have its own provisions for the termination of parental rights. Instead, a separate Chapter 571 proceeding had to be initiated when termination of parental rights was sought. 3 years later, and this is the critical enactment in my view, in 1986, the legislature amended the Child Protective Act and added a new freestanding provision that allows the Department of Human Services to seek permanent custody in a Child Protective Act proceeding. This was Act 316 from the 1986 legislative session, and it added what at the time was a new provision, 587-73, the permanent plan provision. The stated legislative intent of this provision was to avoid the confusion and delay necessitated by having a separate Chapter 571 proceeding to allow for timely permanent planning and to consolidate the proceedings into one. You can see this legislative history in the standing committee reports and the conference committee report from Act 316 in that year. 587-73, the permanent plan provision, governs the criteria, the level of proof, and the method by which termination of parental rights is sought in Chapter 587. And the fact that the 1986 enactment, Act 316, intended to substantively alter the way the termination of parental rights is handled in a Child Protective Act proceeding is confirmed by the other provisions of Act 316 as well. For example, Act 316 also included the requirement, which now appears in the statute, that the petition and the summons both include a written warning to the parents that if they do not comply, termination of parental rights might result. Even more importantly, Act 316 clarified that the level of proof in a termination proceeding is clear and convincing evidence. I note that the addition of 587-73, the permanent plan provision, and this clarification on the burden of proof is significantly more favorable to the parents than the provisions that existed before regarding termination of parental rights, 571, 61, 62, and 63. That brings me to my next point, which is that the provision that the court inquired about, 571-61-B3, does not exist by itself. There are three termination provisions in that chapter that are essentially interlocked by their terms. The other two are 571-62 and 571-63. For our purposes, 571-63 is the more significant one. 571-63, in its first sentence, has a termination standard that is completely different than that is required under 587-73, the permanent plan provision. 571-63 recites only the best interest of the child standard and does not require a safe family home or unfitness finding first, as is required under 587-73, the permanent plan provision. So because, particularly focusing on Act 316, the criteria, the standards, and the burden of proof governing the termination of parental rights, as was added to the Child Protective Act in 1986, is more favorable to parents than the statute that existed at the time, it would be completely contrary to the legislative intent of Act 316 to nevertheless apply 571, 61, 62, and 63.
But nothing you've said so far has indicated to me that it would be inconsistent for the legislature to, in addition to the more specific provisions of 587, also want in a parental rights termination case to make sure mother personally had notice and had the opportunity to look at the motion before, during the hearing? In other words, what I'm hearing from you is that, yeah, there are different procedures that were instituted, but is that inconsistent with a 20-day requirement and personal service on the parent?
I think it is not inconsistent if you look only at the 20-day requirement, if you look at that provisional by itself. And by its face, I agree that it does, if you follow the cross-references to 57111, apply to Child Protective Act proceedings. But, like I said, those three statutes are interlocked. If you look at the way that the 57172 begins, 62 and 63 begin, it's basically an all or nothing proposition. If you accept the logic that the cross-references in 571 mean that this notice provision applies to a Chapter 587 proceeding, that also means that all these other provisions apply. And that is where the inconsistency, in my view, becomes quite
all right,
dramatic.
So you're not saying that there's a legislative intent that they don't like the 20 days, but you're saying there's a legislative intent that they intended that these subsequent procedures or subsequent statutes would trump this existing statute.
That's correct. I think the legislative history from, yes, but with a nuance. The legislative history, particularly the 1986 enactment, shows that when they made this very important change to the Child Protective Act, they intended that it was that statute that would govern the termination of parental rights. And with it, the notice. And it would be, because like I said, the statutes are interlocked, if you try to apply one, the others are sort of tagging along. And it's sort of impossible to apply just one of the three provisions regarding termination of parental rights. So, and in terms of your inquiry about the more specific, more general, that's a rule of statutory construction. But I think that in this case, it doesn't quite fit. Because I could also say that 587.51.5 is the more specific provision because it governs only Chapter 587 provisions versus 571 that involves all different kinds of ways why the family court might arrive at termination of parental rights. So instead of sort of struggling to decide which is the more specific and which is the general, we can instead turn to another rule of statutory construction, which is there are potentially two notice provisions, there's an ambiguity, and we therefore turn to the legislative history. The Hawaii case law also supports our argument that termination of parental rights under the Child Protective Act is handled under the provisions of that chapter. I was unable to find any case law discussing application of the notice provision itself. However, there are Hawaii cases that discuss the interaction between these two chapters. There are two cases that are particularly helpful. The first is In re Jane Doe, 84 Hawaii 41. Where the Hawaii Supreme Court said that it would be absurd to construe either chapter as implicitly limiting the ability of the family court to proceed under the other chapter. And the second case, also In re Jane Doe, 90 Hawaii 200, in which this court found that the provisions for voluntary termination of parental rights under HRS 571-61A did not limit DHS's ability to settle a Child Protective Act proceeding by agreeing to a voluntary termination of parental rights. This court said that nothing in 571-61 or Chapter 587 meant that voluntary termination can only be accomplished by a 571-61A proceeding. And I know that this court reached that conclusion despite the language of 571-61B3, the provision the court inquired about, which by its terms alone applies to both voluntary and involuntary terminations. Just give me moments here. Okay. So to summarize then, there are three reasons why 571-61B3 does not apply. First, Chapter 587 has its own notice provision, which is plain on its face and was both recently enacted and recently reenacted. Second, both the legislative history and a comparison of the relevant provisions from Chapter 571 and 587 show that when termination of parental rights is sought in a Child Protective Act proceeding, it is accomplished under the provisions of that chapter. And third, the Hawaii case law shows that the family court's powers under either chapter are not limited by the other chapter. I'd like to turn now to the mother's argument regarding the default. I think the first place to start with that is the unchallenged findings of fact.
All right, let me ask you if you agree, though. Do you agree that the record shows that this hearing was the first hearing that mother failed to attend?
Yes, Your Honor, and I apologize. I realize that in the answering brief, I identified the December 22nd date as the trial. That's not correct. It would It would have been the initial hearing on the department's motion where the mother would have formally indicated her intent to oppose the motion had she appeared, and subsequent pretrial deadlines would have been set.
All right, so there's no indication that the court had set that as the trial date?
That's correct.
All right. It's like a pretrial hearing kind of thing.
It is, and that's the point in time, and I did look at some other cases that did go to trial to see how that first order was handled, and basically the parent says they're going to contest, they set pretrial deadlines, and they set the trial itself. It appears typically for a couple of months away from the initial hearing date.
All right. I mean, do you have any case law that would suggest that a court previously has upheld a default based upon a mother's missing one hearing, terminating parental rights based upon missing one hearing?
I have no published authority, no, Your Honor.
Isn't that extreme, taking a child from a mother without a hearing because she missed one hearing?
I don't believe it's extreme. And the reason that I say that is that I'm not going to contest that this is an inherently important decision or even the gravity of it at all. But when mother's counsel indicated that, you know, mother didn't know what was going on or she didn't have any notice of the nature of these proceedings, that is completely incorrect. The record shows that mother was warned repeatedly in multiple documents, literally years in advance, that if she did not comply, the termination of parental rights would result. That appears in the petition, in the summons, in the service plans. And then due process, which he would invoke in his brief, requires only notice and an opportunity to be heard. And if you fail to avail yourself of that opportunity.
Now, if you're charged with a crime and you fail to appear, you get your bail revoked, right? There's a sanction. They don't convict you, right?
Well, that's correct, Your Honor.
And this, to me, is probably the closest in a civil proceeding that we have. I mean, there are some mothers that would rather go to prison than have their child taken from them. Even the standard of evidence is pretty high. It's not beyond reasonable doubt, but it's pretty high.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Isn't there some other sanction that could be imposed?
I don't know if there could be some other sanction at this point in the proceedings. Under the Child Protective Act itself, once a certain amount of time has gone by and a parent is not able to demonstrate the ability to provide a safe family home.
Well, her child's not being taken from her for failure to demonstrate. She didn't get a hearing, did she?
Well, she did not get a hearing, Your Honor. But what I was going to say was that the structure of the Child Protective Act moves the proceedings toward termination if the parent has failed to demonstrate their ability to provide a safe family home by a certain point. So that's why I would hesitate to say that there would be another penalty that the court could enter, because we can't keep the case in a holding pattern forever if mother fails to appear. And the interests of the child, of course, are paramount to the
So to
court.
Continue for just another hearing is just
not
an
option?
I don't think that
had the family court done that, that would have been an abuse of discretion, but that does not mean that the family court's entry of default in these circumstances
now,
wasn't.
Does the state have a particular interest in taking a child from a mother without a hearing?
The state's interest in removing the child was when the child was in imminent danger.
I'm talking about, you know, permanently taking the child from the mother. Does the state have an interest in doing that without a hearing?
The state has an interest not so much in that alone, but in the ability to move these proceedings along. I have inquired, and apparently a parent's failing to appear.
So from beginning to end in this proceeding is how much time?
Well, the proceeding has not yet ended because the child is not adopted. But from the proceeding, from the beginning of her going into foster custody until the department's filed this motion was about 18 months. But she was
So 2 or 3 more weeks would have been too much?
Like I said, I don't think that if the family court had done that, that would have been an abuse of discretion. But that conclusion does not mean that what the family court did do was an abuse of discretion.
No, but one of the questions I have is that the state cites the family court's findings mm-hmm. in support of its position.
Mm-hmm.
But in this case, because mother was defaulted,
mm-hmm.
there was no one to contest the evidence put forward by the state upon which the findings were based.
Mm-hmm.
And so doesn't that raise a due process concern? In other words, you're relying upon findings to support the court's ultimate decision
mm-hmm.
to terminate parental rights, but really there is no findings on the merits because the mother was defaulted. It's like a you know, really, it's essentially the judge asked the state to write up the findings and sign it without anybody having an opportunity, due process-wise, to oppose what the state was asserting.
Well, my answer would be both yes and no. You are correct that there was no evidentiary hearing, but to the extent that counsel indicated that there's no evidence, that is incorrect. There's a lot of evidence in the record, and the way that they do this is they admit a series of reports in the guardian ad litem's reports and reports on how the mother is doing in a numeric series from the beginning, and all of that comes in at the trial.
Right, but doesn't due process give the opposing party the opportunity to challenge that evidence?
It does.
And in this case, mother did not have the opportunity because she was defaulted.
Well, she didn't have the opportunity because she didn't show. So she failed to avail herself of that opportunity. So, like I said, I'm not suggesting that I would take this lightly. It is a termination of parental rights. However, if you were to conclude that the mother has to show at the trial in order for us to terminate parental rights, that would mean that all they have to do to stop the department from getting this child or any other child a stable permanent home is not show up over and over.
How about one continuance? Isn't that enough?
Well, like I said,
we're not talking over and over and over.
No, but what Judge Nakamura just suggested, that logic would allow a parent to do exactly that.
Well, it's a proportionality determination. Obviously, if you have a persistent non-shower,
right. At
some point, obviously, the court can say, look, you know, you've shown by your conduct that you're not interested in this case, so we're not going to hold it up.
To some extent,
the difficulty in this case is that we're talking about one failure to appear where there is at least a history of appearing both before and after.
Well, that is correct. I mean, she did show up for the other hearings. However, I think you have to look at the complete circumstances, and there's several things about that that are relevant to this particular case. The first and probably most important is that mother cannot possibly have been unaware that this could result if she didn't comply, because at the beginning of this proceeding, within 60 days or so, her parental rights to her three older children were terminated. I think it was April of 2008. This child was removed in May of 2008. So her contention that she doesn't understand the nature of the proceedings, I think that is basically not credible. She had fits and starts. She did have times in the record where she was complying with services, but complying with services, showing up to the parenting classes is not enough. And when you get closer to the end of the proceeding, she started testing positive for meth. She said, admitted flat out that she was back on drugs. All of these things that she did that showed the department that, you know what, she's not really serious about it, and showing up was not enough.
Right, so, but I mean, we're not contesting that if mother had an opportunity to go through a hearing and that evidence was put on and she had a chance to challenge it and the court ultimately made those findings that the termination on the merits may be supported.
Mm-hmm.
But procedurally in this case, that never happened. In other words, there was no contested hearing on the merits in which mother had the opportunity to challenge the evidence after which the court made findings. In this case, there's no decision on the merits. Ultimately, because the mother was defaulted for failing to show up for that one hearing, she really lost her ability to contest the state's motion.
She did, by failing to show up on what is a dispositive.
So shouldn't our focus be on whether the granting of the motion based upon the failure to show up, isn't that our focus, as opposed to what other evidence in the record there is to support the termination had a full evidentiary hearing be held? Because it's not a merit. The court didn't rule on the merits. The court defaulted her, right?
The court did default her. I mean, I don't think that necessarily means that the findings of fact are meaningless, because they are based on evidence in the record. But if you want to focus on the question of whether the court should have granted the default, the standard is abuse of discretion. So the fact that any other court might reach a different result is not the question. The question is whether in the circumstances of this case, and in 587 proceedings, the judges are instructed to take into account the entire context of the case, because they must, because the child's future is being determined by what they do at any one time. And it's abuse of discretion standard. If you apply the two provisions of the relevant law, which would be the good cause standard under Family Court Rule 55C, and the general civil standard for default, which is the same standard that my opponent recited, that the non-defaulting party will not be prejudiced, that the defaulting party has a meritorious defense, and the default was not the result of inexcusable neglect or willful act.
But correct me if I'm wrong, but the cases that you cite in support of the argument that a default was not an abuse of discretion are really garden variety civil cases. I didn't see any case in which it involved the termination of parental rights in a court entering a default, which suggests to me that at least in this context, it's a fairly rare occasion for a court to terminate a child's parental rights based upon a no-show by a parent.
Well, in terms of what actually happens on the ground, Your Honor, I did inquire with our family law division, and I was told that they are distressingly common when the parents do not appear.
When they never show up, in other words, a situation in which they never show up.
Right.
You know, you try to serve the parent, and you don't know who the parent is, and never show up.
This is the second part, where they have appeared like this mother did, and then they just don't show at the critical hour when the termination of parental rights is on the table. In terms of authority, I would love if I could give you some Hawaii authority, but there is no published authority applying this civil standard. But I do think that it is the better one. I mean, although Judge Foley, of course, is correct, it's in between a regular contract case and a criminal case. But the family court rules apply something much more similar to civil than criminal. We're talking about being able to get default of a judgment or default of a dispositive motion. Now, applying those phrases to this proceeding is not quite a fit, because as you know, the family courts don't issue judgments like the circuit courts do, but a motion for permanent custody is as close to a dispositive motion as we get, and the reason that we're here today is because the Hawaii courts have determined that resolution of that motion is sufficiently final to invoke appellate jurisdiction. So following that logic, then a parent should have the ability to use the family court rule and challenge a default. And when you follow that, that means she must show good cause and applying the civil standard that I recited. So that's where I think that her argument completely falters. I agree, there's no prejudice to DHS, but she must demonstrate all three of the prongs. She has no meritorious defense, because it's not that she has a defense or that she would have made an argument. She has a meritorious defense, and I think she does not. The facts most recently in the record about her drug use, she stopped going to therapy, whatever participation she was doing earlier, she was not doing anymore. And this is after her being in services for 5 years, not 18 months, because she had the previous children just before, and she only had just barely started to show any kind of progress, and then, you know, failed to continue. She has no good cause, because the reason she gave is, you know, I wasn't listening to the dates, and to me, that's not enough. I see that my time is nearly up. Is there any other questions the court has? I'm just going to leave it at that then. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I reserve the
rebuttal
time? Can I?
Go ahead. I think you have some time left.
I did want to point out, under 587 cases, the type of notice when parents are summoned is that your rights as a parent could be terminated. Okay, that's in bold letters. Okay, I think that's different from a notice that if you fail to appear, automatically you lose your parental rights by default. You don't have a hearing. What is alleged automatically is assumed to be findings of facts and conclusions of law. So I think there is a difference. There was a question about state's interest. Yes, there is. I think there is a state's interest in this, in the sense that you want proceedings to follow, which is fair to all parties concerned. The best interest of the child is and the parents' interest as parents. Because unless you have the fairness and the procedural requirements, what happens is, and the department's position is, they do not allow an adoption in a TPR or permanent custody if the appeal is still pending. So is that in the best interest of the child if procedural requirements have not been met? It's not in the best interest of the parent either if things are delayed.
So that's the tension that supports the state interest in expediting things. In other words, there is a flip side to the mother losing parental rights. If the mother is an unfit mother, then for the benefit of the child, it makes sense to try to expedite it so that the child may be able to find another family.
That's correct in terms of the child's interest. But on the other hand, the flip side is also that if there's an appeal filed, it's not in the child's best interest if procedural requirements were not followed properly. Then, because there's a delay until the appeal is completed, depending upon the result of the appeal, the child is in limbo. So that's the opposite side. And you know, the final thing is, again, the parents are not told that you fail to appear. Well, some judges are now doing it. Parents are not told that if you fail to appear at the next court hearing, the court can proceed and your rights could be terminated or whatever. They don't get that notice, as Judge Nakamura, you are asking about. So they're not aware if I fail to show up in 1 in 8 hearings that, at least in this case, automatically my rights as a mother is terminated. They may know that, and as the deputy indicated, her older children went through the process, but I'm sure it wasn't by default. Otherwise, she would have brought that up as being that the same scenario in mother's second case. Thank you.
Take the case under advisement.